When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Gonna start off with a sad note. One of my favorite people in the labor movement, Tom Conway, president of the International Steelworkers Union, he passed away today. And, as head of the United Steelworkers, was a guy who was always forward-looking, always out there fighting for members, fighting for better opportunities, and it's a sad day. He was 71 years old, so our thoughts, our prayers, our hopes go out to his family and to the steelworker family on this day. Some good news today, however. The Writers Guild, they have a tentative agreement. There's something they're taking back to the members, which means that could be ending. That strike could be ending. And from what I'm hearing, and there are no official details let out there yet, what I'm hearing, this is what they want. This is what they need. So I'm hoping ending that whole, we're just going to use AI to write everything. I'm hoping that people can make a living doing this so we can get back to watching the shows and the things that they produce for us. Now, over the weekend, I spent the weekend traveling through Ohio and Michigan, visiting striking workers in my quest to promote the Adopt a Worker, a Striking Worker program. And I'm hoping you find a picket line, you get out there, you adopt a striker for a day, walk in their shoes, talk to them, hear their stories, hear their complaints, and hear their pride and passion for the work they do. Now, look, there are a lot of people, they're just greedy and all that. No, these are people who are passionate about their work, proud of it. In fact, the folks at the Jeep picket line, when I drove up in my Jeep, were cheering the guy driving the Jeep. And I got to tell you, the Jeep people were fantastic. Took me around, we talked to everyone. I had, just some incredible conversations. And they have a track in the Jeep facility for the Jeeps to play on. Because I was joking with my son that, my Jeep is going to its birthplace. Going back, it's kind of like going home again. And we were joking because it literally has a track that you can drive, like rocks and, all kinds of obstacles that evidently before Stellantis took over, they used to bring in professional drivers and drive this thing on the family picnic days. Stellantis did away with the family picnics. And again, this is part of what we found when we were talking to people. This idea that during the pandemic, they were They were essential. They were frontline heroes. They were out there doing the work that made a quarter of $1 trillion in profit for the folks at the very top. And they're a little hurt by what's gone on. They're a little angry about the fact that they were promised, you know, the concessions they made to save these companies would be brought back, that they would be made whole down the road once everyone was doing well. And that hasn't happened, and it's not happening yet. There's some very good talks at Ford. We'll see. But this is that battle. This is that fight. And I had the opportunity to talk with people in both worlds, the folks who were there 40, 50 years, and the people who have been there 5, 10 years. The people who remember when this was those jobs were the gold standard of the working class, and how, you know, one income supported a family very well. And how now you've got couples who are working in there trying to make ends meet. And this idea that they want to leave something better for their children. In fact, in the Wayne, Michigan area, we went to the Ford plant and talked to a guy who was there 52, 50 some odd years he spent in that plant. And he said, look, you know, I'm okay. I'm going to have my retirement. I've made, you know, enough money that I'm going to be okay here soon when I retire. I'm worried about that guy over there, my friend. I'm worried about those people across the street who are walking the picket line, who are my coworkers and my friends, my union brothers and sisters. I'm worried about them and their families. I'm worried about their children. And the idea of a legacy, the quote unquote legacy employees, are worried about their legacy and what they're going to leave for the next generation. And I find that just it's just really great. Now, Ford, you know, for all the talk of things going better, have now come out and said, well, maybe they're going to stop construction on an EV plant. Which is, again, you know, trying to send a signal, like Stellantis said, we'll move to Mexico. And as we talked about Jim Cramer, I'd move them all to Mexico. You know, put those workers in their place. But I thought Sean Fain had the right frame. He said, this is shameful. This is a shamefully barely veiled threat by Ford to cut jobs. Closing 65 plants over the last 20 years wasn't enough for the big three. Now they want to threaten us with closing plants that aren't even open yet. We are simply asking for a just transition to electric vehicles, and Ford is instead doubling down on their race to the bottom. And this got me thinking, based on how weird our economy is set up, which is telling CEOs and the wealth class, make as much money as you can because you're going to get praised for it. Make as much money as you can because you're going to be a rock star. I think Jim Cramer said that, you know, we should treat CEOs like professional athletes and pay them accordingly. And you go, well, wait a second. We have an economy based on those CEOs figuring out how to squeeze the quarter until the eagle screams that we hand to workers. So squeeze wages down to you know, barely getting by, cut benefits, cut little things like the picnic at the Jeep plant. Cut the things that make employment, you know, tolerable, that make, you know, the working for a company enjoyable and what you want people to be. No, we're going to gut all of that. And then we're going to use that money. We're going to use that money to then go after, you know, government and get tax breaks and get all kinds of stuff to get bailed out when we get into trouble. Because they know, hey, the politicians don't want people, their constituents, losing their jobs. They're going to come in and help out. And then, you know, pushing for deregulation and more power and more control. We've got all of the wrong things in our economy. And it's the voting, it's the working voters who have done this to ourselves. Because, you know, when I tell people, you know, you've got the CEO of GM or Stellantis or Ford making a couple hundred times what the average worker makes, people are like, well, you know, what are they? They don't put a single lug nut on a car. They've never wired anything. They've never bolted a trunk on. They've never done any of that stuff. In fact, I asked all of the people online, have you ever seen the CEO? Have they, you know, pitched in, got some gloves and done some work? No, they do nothing to add to the profitability of the things, the product being made. But what they do, and they do quite effectively, is they squeeze the workforce. What they do quite effectively is they fight for more for them and less for everyone else. And this comes back to us. This comes back to us as a culture. We keep going, you know, we want tax cuts. We've been trained like Pavlovian dogs that anytime we hear the word tax cut, everyone foams at the mouth. Oh, yeah, I've had the tax cuts. Yeah, yeah. And yet we're we're in a moment where tax cuts, you know, have gotten us into really desperate conditions because we have given so much to those at the very top. You know, the smart people, you know, the people who know what to do with the money, make more for themselves at the expense of all the rest of us. There has been a massive redistribution of wealth in this country from the people who actually show up and punch the clock and do the labor to those who, well, the hardest day's work they do is move money from one pocket to the other. And this was, you know, what we talked about as I was visiting these workers on the line. The people who were there, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they remember how good it was, how good the companies were. And this, you know, globalization has a huge part of this. I mean, you look at Chrysler. The one guy was trying to tell me all the people who have owned Chrysler over the years, you know, Daimler and, you know, just a bunch of them. Sebris and, you know, going back and forth. And you go Fiat and every time what happens is these companies come in, they suck all the technology out, they squeeze the workers for more. And it's all about, again, squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams. More profit. And we keep hearing the same frames from our corporate controlled media. How come I've not heard any of the pundits of the financial world question why we're paying executives who do nothing productive? They do nothing to add value to the vehicle that you put your behind in and pay your hard-earned cash for. They do virtually nothing to produce that. And yet somehow we justify their millions of dollars while saying someone doesn't deserve 25. It's really kind of twisted. It's really kind of bizarre, and it comes back to us. And this is why, you know, when we were on the line, I got this great T-shirt that said, "Respect the power of solidarity." As these people came together and as they're out walking that picket line, they know exactly why they're there. Now, I've been on picket lines over the years where not everybody quite was on the same page, and give the UAW credit for the education process. And I would argue this is what happens when you have a member-led organization. This is what happens when you have a member-led strike, which is what this is. I know they keep trying to box in Sean Fain as a union boss, but he's only putting forth what the members are asking for, what the members want, what the working people want. And I know that's hard to understand. I know it's hard for us to grasp, given the fact that we don't get to see it very often. But we're in this second where, you know, the tactics that they're using are pure democracy. Now, I love how Axios framed this today, and I'm glad that, you know, they put this out here, because, you know, Sean Fain's acting an awful lot like a politician because of this election, acting a lot like the politicians promising stuff. And you go, he hasn't promised anything. They wrote the automakers are frustrated, not just by the UAW's tactics, but what they say is misinformation spread by the union. Now the auto companies have, GM has responded, saying that, you know, UAW's demands are unattainable and refusing claims made by Fain and workers that they work at poverty levels. They said the bottom line, Fain is operating more like a politician rallying the constituents than a backroom union boss, and some industry observers wonder whether he's over promising and what he can deliver. Not what every person to a man, to a woman on those picket lines said. These are our demands. There's no union boss telling us what we're getting. This is what we put forth. So it's not Fain saying that this is our demands. This is, you know, 150,000 workers saying this is what we demand. And this is what we stand for. And look, every one of them knew that they weren't going to get everything they asked for. But it was the first time in their memory that their union had gone to the bargaining table and told the world, this is what we're fighting for. And whether they get the 40% raise or just 25, They fought for something. Whether they get the 32-hour week work week or not, it's brought it into the American lexicon. We're now going to talk about that. Good things, historic things are going to come out of this strike. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the shutdown's coming. Look, I don't see any way McCarthy's going to be able to spin this starting on Tuesday. I think the crazy caucus is going to be only crazier, more emboldened. And in fact, you had Donald Trump come out and say that he's called for congressional Republicans to shut down the federal government unless, and this is all in capitals, all capital letters, because he shouts this stuff in his truth post, unless you get everything. That's everything. Every bit of wish list thing. Shut the government down. Cost the taxpayers millions of dollars. Because, oh, by the way, did I tell you that these shutdowns not free? That you do have to pay the workers. You do have to pay the extra work, the overtime. All this is on the taxpayers' back, and they don't save anything. None of the government shutdowns that we've had, and this is one of those things you go, duh, none of these have saved a dime. But it's a nice display. It's a nice opportunity for crazy to get their name on television, to get their face on television. And you go, when do we go? Now here's fun. This is fun. I always love this. I always love this part because they want to keep the impeachment inquiry going. Granny, you're not going to get your check. The national parks aren't going to be open. The Smithsonian's closed. You and the VA might not get the care that you need as quickly as you need it. But the impeachment inquiry, oh, that's going to have to go forward. Now, you go back to Trump's comment, got to get everything they want. What do they want? Well, I mean, clearly, they've told us, and it's one of those things that at some point we've got to listen. They want to steal Social Security. They want to destroy Medicare. They want to force you to work until you drop dead. They want to remake the 20th century. That's the goal, and they've been very clear about this. It's not hard. It's not hard. And they want to defund, you know, they want to do Putin's work of, you know, we're not going to give any more money to or help to Ukraine, which, again, I'm not quite sure why this is their drop dead point, but it's another one of those things. Now, like I said, I think McCarthy is going to have a rough week, and it will be what decides his fate if he's going to be speaker, because as we said when he got the job. And I was very clear that I wanted the job for him because I wanted him to have the heartburn and the acid reflux and the heart palpitations that come along with the kind of stress that his own members are putting him under. But will he have a job? Because he did the dumb thing. You know, one person can seek to vacate the chair. Oh, it's going to be entertaining. But cost us millions and possibly billions of dollars. Let's go to the phones. I got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Whoa. You're not insane?
No, today's the day you need to worry. I'm not insane.
Okay, now I'm worried. What's up?
smart move, yes. Get the popcorn out because it's going to be interesting. You know what they want, the Republicans. They want to do away with everything and remake the 21st century back into the 8th or 9th century A.D. But they also are hoping that they can stop all these inquiries about Trump and his cronies. That's what they want. I mean, that's obvious. And now I'm going to flip the switch and go over to the CEOs. Are you aware of the fact, and this has been proven by more than one poll and what have you, that one out of every five CEO of every corporation is either a psychopath, sociopath, or narcissist?
Only one in five? I find that to be very low.
I do too. But if you stop and think about it, that would mean five out of every 25 or 20 out of every 100. So, you know, that's obvious too. And they aren't worth the money that they're getting paid. I never understood that either. No one is worth. And I'm talking athletes, I'm talking actors, politicians, what have you. No one is worth $15 or $20 million a year. I don't care what they do.
I am thrilled if they make $15 or $20 million a year. I hope they make $100 million a year. As long as we have a tax code that the good socialist president Dwight Eisenhower was in charge of. If we're taxing at 92%, I'm thrilled with it. Go ahead, make as much money as you need, and then we'll redistribute it back to we the people and for the things that we need, like roads and bridges and schools and healthcare and all of those things that we've been giving up for far too long. And this UAW strike is a perfect example of this, where you've got these executives who are just lining their pockets with obscene amounts of money and then telling the people who actually do the work, sorry, we can't afford to give you back what we stole from you.
Oh, absolutely. And then we end up having to bail them out, along with the banks and the credit unions and what have you, you know, when everyone does the stupid stuff. And but it's, you know, we have been trained to worship, the sociopaths. You know,
we all want to be rich.
Oh my gosh. You know, they're so special. They aren't. But you have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. I appreciate it. And look, you know, she's right in this. You know, we have given so much power and control to a handful of people to control how our economy works that, you know, I keep waiting for that shake awake moment, and I'm hoping this is it. You know, I remember, what was it, August 19th, 2019, when the business roundtable, you know, our captains of industry, our corporate titans, our oligarch came out and said, you know, we've learned our lesson. You know, we're going to start caring about, you know, the environment and consumers and workers. We promise we're going to start caring. It's no longer about maximizing shareholder value. No. It's about more. It's about, you know, society and being good stewards of the economy and being, you know, good citizens of the country and, you know, patriotic. And, you know, the flags were waving. The music was playing. You know, people were pounding their chest. Oh, boy, corporate America's learned. They're going to do better. Oh, boy, they're going to be better. And then the pandemic hits. And what'd they do? Nothing. They did exactly what they've always done. They squeezed the workers as much as they could. Although this time they did give them nice titles, you know, like essential and frontline heroes. And oh, thank goodness. And they put out flags occasionally for them. You know, heroes work here. Now, we don't pay you like that. But, you know, what's a little PR, a little, you know, pat on the back every once in a while? It doesn't cost that much. What'd they learn? They learned that we're not going to fight back until now. You look at all these strikes that are going on. These are angry working people. And this is why, again, I come back to I support wholeheartedly a adopt a striking worker program. Every union should be promoting this, not just for their members, but for everything. And bring your kids to a picket line. We should be doing that in huge numbers because it's their future that they're fighting for today. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We'll take a quick break. Right back after this. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll get ours. Also, something I said got on your under your skin, on your nerves, or you greet. Always like to hear some agreement. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you might remember on Friday, we were talking about AB 316, a bipartisan bill in California, overwhelming support by both parties to ensure that there is a qualified safety person behind the wheel of every autonomous truck in California. Thought it was going to go through, sail through the governor's office, pretty easily, because it sailed through the legislature pretty easy. Wildly popular with the public, and yet Governor Gavin Newsom evidently decided, nope. His statement, curious, he said Assembly Bill 316 is unnecessary for the regulation and oversight of heavy-duty autonomous vehicle technology in California, as existing law provides sufficient authority to create the appropriate regulatory framework. Now, people that I've talked to, they're saying bunk. And what I'm telling you is what I said on Friday. The first person who gets killed because of one of these autonomous trucks goes off the virtual rails, it's on this guy. And here to share some thoughts on why. In fact, he probably vetoed this as my next guest and I were talking about how important this is. That's why I've asked Jason Rabinowitz to come talk with us. He's the president of Teamsters Joint Council 7. TeamstersJC7.org is the website. Jason, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Glad to be with you.
So am I getting this right? Right about the time that you and I were talking, the governor decides, no, we don't need this. We got it covered.
Yeah, well, late on a Friday night, after refusing to meet with the Teamsters General President Sean O'Brien, refusing to talk to workers about this issue, he cowardly vetoed this bill, which is, as you mentioned, overwhelmingly supported by the public, overwhelmingly supported bipartisan by the legislature. And it's a great disappointment that someone that was supposed to be a friend of working people that said he was going to be on our side, you know, when his job was on the line, he was getting recalled. He came to the Teamsters, he came to the labor movement and said, hey, back me up, save my job, I'll be there with you. We did save his job. Now our jobs are on the line and he's not there with us. And he chose the greedy tech companies and robots and profits over safety and working people, jobs, our communities. And it's really unfortunate. But, you know, this is just the beginning of this fight, Rick. This is the fight for labor of the next decade or more, to protect our jobs and our safety from robots, from AI, trying to take all our jobs. And our fight continues. This is far from the end. In fact, it's just the beginning. We'll continue to fight as Teamsters with the rest of the labor movement, with the rest of our communities, to protect our jobs and safety from these robot trucks and all the AI that they're trying to bring in to take our jobs just so they can boost their profits.
Now, I got to tell you, you know, when I first saw the veto happened, you know, my mind went to hope. You know, I'm going, you know, he's a Democrat. He wants to be president. You know, clearly someday he wants to be president. He's certainly not going to choose the wrong side for no reason. So my first thought was, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he sides with me in that this doesn't go far enough. It's too much of a compromise. No, we need stronger protections instead of this being a person sitting watching the computer. Maybe he thinks that the computer should be helping the worker. And I would be on board with that. But his statement, curious to me, because he says that California law, as it exists, provide sufficient authority to create the appropriate regulatory framework. Do you see that? Do you buy that? Is that possible?
Well, working people don't buy that. Nobody buys that. He wants to put this monumental issue in the hands of the Department of Motor Vehicles and let them decide. And, you know, a decision of this magnitude needs to be made by our elected leaders, by the legislature, by the governor, and not punted to a regulatory bureaucratic agency. And we've been in front of the DMV on this very issue because they moved to issue regulations that would authorize robot trucks out on the freeways. And that's what started this whole thing. And we went out there, we had drivers, Teamster drivers, and our members testify in front of the DMV. And they were totally dismissive of drivers, of workers. All they wanted to listen to was these tech companies who were lying and talking about how safe this technology is when we all know that it's not safe, it's not ready. And so it's clear that the DMV is not taking workers seriously, is not taking unions, our safety, our community seriously. They're too cozy with the tech companies, and this decision should never be in the hands of DMV. So when he says that that the DMV is the right place for this decision to take place, he's dead wrong.
You know,
and we reject that entirely.
You know, over the weekend, my son and I, we were traveling through Ohio and Michigan to visit UAW picket lines, and we happened to catch a Guardians baseball game. And as we're sitting in the heart of downtown Cleveland, in the stadium with, you know, 15,000-16,000 people, my cell phone got nothing. I could Google nothing. I could search nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Couldn't text. Couldn't do anything because too many people on the system. We've bogged down the system. So immediately as I'm sitting there, I'm going, now imagine rush hour traffic coming in to downtown Cleveland, into New York City, into Washington, D.C., into Los Angeles. Imagine all of those trucks on this virtual rail, this 5G that we're not sure works yet. I'm sorry, it may be safe for one truck with 50 people watching it, but I'm sorry, a million trucks on the road with nobody watching, I got real problems with this.
Oh, well, yeah, and we saw what happened in San Francisco. There's about 1,000 of these robot taxis on the road. There was a concert there. A bunch of people came in the city, jammed up the cell phone network. Next thing you know, all these cars are stalling out all over the city because the cell phone network went down. And Cruz and Waymo say, oh, well, it's not our fault. It's the cell phone network. Well, no. What if you said rush hour traffic? What if there's a disaster, an earthquake, a fire, and the network goes down right at the moment we need our streets clear for the ambulances and the fire trucks, and all these robot trucks, robot cars stall out because their signal goes down? What if the signal goes down when the truck's going, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles an hour down the freeway next to some family in their minivan next to our kids? The technology is not ready. And these tech companies don't care about that. They just care about our profits. So that's why we need our elected leaders, like our governor, to care about us. But in this moment where everything's on the line, he turned his back on us. And, you know, we're going to remember that. And if he wants to run for president or dog catcher or anything in between, we're going to remember this moment when our jobs and our safety were on the line. And he chose the greedy tech companies and the robots over us.
So where do you go from here, Jason? Because well, you know, obviously he vetoed this, and I'm with you, kind of like a thief in the night. I don't know why you do this, you know, on a late night Friday, but this is what the governor chose. Because I think that's more of a slap in the face than vetoing it, to be honest. Because it's like, well, they won't notice. They're off for the weekend. This will blow over by Monday. I stewed about it all weekend, and I wasn't even on the campaign with you guys. So where do you go from here with this?
Well, he can try to hide out on a Friday night, but workers are going to remember. And this fight has just begun. The vast majority of the public supports our bill, supports this idea. The vast majority of the legislature, Democrats and Republicans, support it. So we're going to continue to fight on the legislative front, and we're going to fight on every front to make sure that we continue to protect our jobs and our safety from these robot trucks. You know, his veto message was so disingenuous, Rick. It said, oh, this is inflexible approach and this stops innovation. This doesn't stop innovation in the least. It doesn't stop them from running a single autonomous truck on the road. All it says is that if they want to run these robot trucks, they have to put a human operator in there to ensure safety. And their hypocrisy is totally exposed by the fact that they oppose this, because if they really thought it was just about safety, like they claim, these greedy tech companies would be very happy to say, okay, we'll put a human operator in there to ensure safety. That's a belt and suspenders, right? They claim their trucks are so safe, but if there's a problem, there's a human safety operator. No, the truth is that they're trying to eliminate jobs, human driving jobs, because they want to save money and boost their profits. And they're willing to put driverless robot trucks 80,000 pounds on the freeway before the technology is ready, endangering all of our lives just to save a buck.
Yeah. No, I mean, in the example you gave, the example of the taxis is a perfect example. If the taxis can't work, if you can't make little things work, why are you going to the biggest things on the road?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense other than because you want to rush it out before it's ready in order to eliminate jobs and boost your profits.
No.
And that's where the unions come in. And that's where our elected leaders should come in. And I'm glad that our legislature stood up and did the right thing. And I'm embarrassed and disappointed by our governor, who was supposed to be our friend, who cowardly took the side of the greedy tech companies instead of working people in safety. And we're going to remember that when it comes time for him to run for anything else. We know where he stands.
Let me ask you this. Your general president, Sean O'Brien, tweeted out today that the bill has 95% bipartisan support in the legislature, 75% public support, and yes, Newsom killed it. For those of us who don't know California politics as maybe as well as we should, or the mechanisms of how they work, I think every state has a way to overturn a veto. With 95% bipartisan support, is that a possibility that the legislature can overturn this and say we're going to put it into law? How does it work in California?
Well, no question. In California, the legislature can override with 2/3 vote of both houses. We got well more than that when we passed the bill to begin with. So we're looking at all our options, Rick, and we're looking at the best way to bring this thing back. I can say that, you know, we have the right to reintroduce it. We have the right to look at an override. But the people want this. The legislature wants this. We're not going to let one man who's too close to the greedy tech companies to stop us from protecting our jobs and our safety. So we're looking at our options, and we're going to be moving forward. But this is just the beginning.
Yeah, I visit California. I want you to have it because yeah. I don't want to be driving through there. And I also know that California is a driver for policy across the rest of the country. So if you guys can't seem to get this done, I don't think Mississippi or Florida or any other places that I've been are going to consider that either.
Well, I this is why California is so important, because we do think that it sets the tone for policy elsewhere. But, you know, this is a bipartisan issue. This is not a Republican or Democratic issue. There's plenty, you know, we had a Republican co-sponsor. Almost all the Republican legislators voted for this thing. And we've seen in lots of deep red states where the people and the legislators are standing right in the same with the same idea that we are, that we need to stand up to these greedy tech companies. We need to stop these robot trucks from coming in. I think it's going to happen all around the country where people are going to stand up to this.
See, this, to me, this isn't a bipartisan issue. This is a nonpartisan issue. This should not be at all partisan, because, look, I don't care who vetoed it or who approved it. That truck comes careening down the road and runs off the virtual rails and kills somebody I know. I don't care if they wore a red hat or a blue hat. I just know that this should not have been allowed to happen. Before I let you go, I got to get your thoughts on the news today that there's a tentative agreement in the Writers Guild strike. They've pulled down the pickets for now, pending ratification. Any thoughts?
Well, yeah, the labor is resurgent all over the place, where workers are fed up with corporate greed. And, you know, you've got these very powerful and rich entertainment companies that, you know, it's just like with the robot trucks. They want robots to write the screenplays and they want robots to act in the movies. They want to take people's labor writing the scripts and pay them peanuts. And the workers stood up and courageously took the strike, and they held on, and they ended up getting a tentative agreement that's recommended. We're very proud that the Teamsters Union And especially our Hollywood local 399 under leadership of Lindsay Doherty, who's an international vice president, stood up for the writers and for the actors and made it clear, if you got a picket line on one of these productions, our Teamster trucks are not going through there. We're standing in solidarity. And we're proud that the Teamsters Union has helped in our way to contribute to this win. And, you know, workers are going to keep standing up, whether it's UAW, SAG-AFTRA. My local 2010 is potentially going to be on strike against California State University together with all the other unions there very shortly. Workers are fed up, sick and tired of the rich getting richer and enriching themselves like these CEOs with their huge profits and their huge executive compensation, and expecting workers to accept peanuts for the work that we do that makes them rich. And so I'm very proud of the writers for their fight, and they've set a great example for the rest of labor.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, I had framed the writers' strike and the Screen and Actors Guild as the front line of the class war, the war on technology. I mean, we're getting beat up by robots and AI and all this. This is the beginning of that that tech fight, and I'm anxious to find out what came out of this and you know the good things that they got out of this. But here's the thing, because clearly our politicians aren't going to help us. It's something that we got to do for ourselves.
And workers are doing it. Workers are standing up everywhere from in every industry. And it's a great moment to be part of the labor movement because we're fighting and we're winning like we haven't in a long time. So we're just going to have to keep up the battle.
There you go.
And, you know, we've got these greedy tech companies. They've got a lot of innovations, Rick, a lot of good new technology, but there's nothing innovative about union busting. There's nothing innovative about underpaying workers and trying to take away their jobs and take away their livelihood. And so we're going to fight that tooth and nail. We welcome innovation, but we will stand up to union busting and exploitation at every turn. And I'm proud that the Teamsters Union is part of this fight.
Amen. Jason, I appreciate you taking time for us. Come back and talk to us again soon, especially as the strike that you've got coming up comes online. I'd love to hear more from you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Anytime.
Our good friend Jason Rabinowitz, he is the president of Teamsters Joint Council 7, TeamstersJC7.org, the website if you want to keep up with the work that they do. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1961. That was the day when Herbert Lee was murdered just outside of Liberty, Mississippi. He was a successful black cotton farmer who became active in efforts to register black voters. Lee had 9 children. He was one of the few area black farmers with a vehicle. This made him very valuable to the voter registration movement. Lee would drive Bob Moses from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee around Amet County to reach unregistered voters. It was dangerous work to register black sharecroppers and farmers in rural Mississippi. Attempts by black residents to gain legal or economic equality were met with threats and violence. On the morning of his murder, Lee had come to the Westbrook Cotton Gin just outside of Liberty to drop off a truckload of cotton. There, he was met by a childhood friend, Mississippi State Representative E.H. Hurst. Hurst came up to the truck and started shouting at Lee. Then he took out a gun and shot Herbert Lee in the head. Witnesses stated that Lee had brandished a tire iron at Hurst. Hurst claimed self-defense. A jury declared the murder was justifiable homicide. Lewis Allen, a black farmer and timber worker, was one who had testified about witnessing the shooting. Later, he recanted his testimony, saying that he had lied about Lee threatening Hurst because he feared for his life. After Allen began to talk about what he actually saw that day, he became the victim of harassment and beatings. Finally, on January 31st, 1964, he too was gunned down in his driveway. No one was ever convicted or even arrested for his murder. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Wow, I just got a text from a relative who lives back where I went to high school. Wow. Evidently, the high school football, the coach of the high school that I graduated from and played football for years at, evidently the coach has resigned after his term was... Evidently, he used a Nazi slur. He used the word Nazi repeatedly as a term to call out plays during a game in Beechwood. Evidently, the student body in Beechwood is 90% Jewish. I wonder if that had something to do with the audible and the play call. I just kind of spitball. It's scary. I mean, the area I grew up in, which was, again, solidly a working class, unionized, you know, upper middle class-ish, you know, hardworking area, a lot of blue-collar workers, you know, having, you know, gone the Trump way. And, you know, this is a sign of, and again, what I said from the beginning was, where I grew up, those folks believed all those jobs that they lost because of bad policy Trump was going to bring back. They truly believe that. They internalize it. You know, look, you know, Cleveland, where I grew up, was a very segregated area. So racism and misogyny were, in my youth, were the norm. All of the things that they're accused of. But it wasn't that moved these people. It was the economy. It was the jobs. And it's the undercurrent of what's going on now as well. Because the economy is, on paper, doing pretty well. But read a newspaper, read our news accounts, things not good. The messaging that the corporatists and the right wing have put out is everything's horrible and it's all Joe Biden's fault. And yet the economy that he inherited from Trump was terrible. Massive unemployment. And yet, you know, Biden has done, in my view, a lot of the right things to move us in the right direction. And it's hard to not remember the chaos of the Trump years. So a little chaos today. Evidently, Marjorie Trainwreck Greene took Donald Trump gun shopping. Chaos rules the day. Now, remember, this is how Trump ran government. Everything was chaotic. He walked out of a gun store with a gun he can't have. The same way he tried to walk out of the White House with thousands of documents that he can't have. This level of entitlement. And we'll call it Glock Gate. Evidently, there was a Glock that had a picture or an image of him on the handle. And he's taking a picture with it, all smiles, you know. And he said, you know, he was going to buy one. And, you know, he said, you know, I got to have one of those. I want to have one. I want to buy one. And the initial reporting is that he bought it, which then sent all the people scratching their heads because someone under federal indictment, you know, 91 felony charges, can't buy a gun. So in public, in front of us, with his future VP, because I'm thinking, you know, he's trying some of them out, he openly commits a federal offense. Now, immediately all my left friends are going, we should lock him up for this. I'm going, no, I don't think he bought it. And then the news report comes out saying, no, he didn't buy one. You know, and then they tapped it back because they realize, oh, you know what? That's a federal offense. Now, I, from the beginning, said there's no way he bought it. There's just no way he bought it. And I had a friend go, well, why wouldn't he buy it? Because did he think that he was breaking the law? No, he doesn't care about the law. He could care less. He could shoot. Remember, I can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose a vote. He doesn't buy anything. He's used to stiffing people. He's used to getting stuff on the arm. Walk into a restaurant, you know, hey, I'm Donald Trump, on the arm. He fancies himself a mob guy. He would never reach into his pocket and spend $900 on something he doesn't need or want or just pay. So, you know, this is the weird thing. Now, again, that flaunting of the law, pretty powerful on that side. And this is why the gun fetishists love him so much. And that flaunting of the law part, you know, this was all performative is what it was. This is, you know, get me a little media attention. Endure me to my gun fetish friends. Now, if a gun was transferred to him, whether he did buy it and they zeroed it out for, no, we'll just let you purchase it or we'll just give it to you. That's still a crime, as I understand. And that's the thing that you know, gets me. If he did walk out of there with a gun, it's not him who should be in trouble. It's the gun owner. It's the gun shop owner who should be the one. And are you telling me that the guy who was owning the gun shop, clearly a supporter of Trump, didn't know he was under indictment for 91 felonies? And again, was that not the performative part to go, hey, look at me. I'm a good Trump gun nut. Come do business in my gun nut store. I think I'm right on this. The point of the whole thing, the whole point of the whole display was to own the libs. We got them all worked up, didn't we? And we got lots of attention. And made the base all tingly in the panties.
Whenever there's a gun and a broken law, you know there's an NRA guy just warm and fuzzy down there.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a video caught my attention the other day that, you know, every father, it's literally every father's nightmare to have their young daughter raped and impregnated by some dirtbag. And then to have our current law say, you know what? Sorry, your 10 or 11 or 12 year old daughter. Yeah, this horrible thing happened. This tragedy happened. But, you know, she's going to have to carry it to term. Sorry. That's just the law. There's nothing we can do. And, you know, as a father, I watched this video and it made me very angry, as I think every father, well, I think it should. And here to share some thoughts on the video, I've asked Joe Jacobson to come talk with us. Joe is the founder of Progress Action Fund. They're the folks behind this video, which we'll get out on social media. Also under the hashtag of MAGA is watching you. And look, you know, when these folks get their eye, remember, they want smaller, less intrusive government, except in your bedroom. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So this video has made the rounds. It's gone viral. It's gotten lots of attention, as it should. Tell me why. Why'd you make it?
Well, we think Republicans are extreme. And, you know, it needs to be called out. That's the first and foremost thing. But also, most political ads are kind of boring and pretty similar, as I'm sure you know. And based on our last ad we did, the Keep Republicans Out of Your Bedroom one, that went viral first, is on CNN, MSNBC, hell, even Fox News picked it up. We had a Republican congressman literally invade somebody's bedroom while they were trying to, you know, be intimate and get a condom, saying they banned birth control. So we thought we needed to make this ad, not only because reproductive rights is important, but also because, you know, I feel Democrats aren't communicating in a way that resonates with voters as much as it could be. And there's nothing quite like a congressman entering your bedroom or a congressman entering the doctor's office telling your daughter and your family what you can and cannot do.
Now, what's interesting to me is I shared that video with some of my red hat wearing acquaintances, and they all told me that that's not how it is. That, you know, that would never happen in this country. It could never happen. That's not what they're fighting for. Is it what they're fighting for?
I mean, I think Republican politicians are out of touch with the voters. And I'm glad to hear that your, you know, MAGA hat wearing friends are saying that. But I think we need to be looking at what the people who they're voting for are for. You know, you have people in Pennsylvania like Doug Mastriano, who ran for governor, who wants no exceptions for rape, incest, or life of the mother. You know, Dr. Oz, his famous quote from last cycle in Pennsylvania was, these decisions should be between, you know, a family, a doctor, and the local politician. And then you have Carolyn Carluccio. You know, we're running this ad for the upcoming Supreme Court race. And Carluccio, who is the Republican nominee, she is very pro-life. She even funds pro-life causes with her nonprofit. You know, that's her position as far as I'm concerned. So these Republican voters, you know, they, I think, would need to be reached out to by folks like us, because the politicians they're voting for just really don't have the same values that they do.
Do you see this as an opportunity to maybe educate some of the less ardent red hats, some of the more, maybe if there are any moderate Republicans, you know, people, you know, like me, who've got teenage daughters, who you go, you know, I don't want someone in that room making a decision, taking a choice away from her. Do you think, see this as an education opportunity, or is this just to rally the base?
Well, I really think it's both. I think you can do both, because this ad, you know, it's gone viral. It's had over 8 million views on Twitter in less than a week, which we're very excited about. So it's definitely a rallying cry for Democrats. We need to stand up for our values. But at the same time, you know, this is something Republican voters agree. You know, you mentioned your MAGA hat friends again, and, you know, they do not want this. So I really think it's a good education opportunity. But also, you know, this type of ads that we create, I think, you know, can be for persuasion, not just in Pennsylvania, but also in Ohio. You know, we really had strong victories in the August elections when we ran our Keep Republicans Out of Your Bedroom ad. And we saw 15 counties that voted for Trump in 2020 voted no, meaning that they wanted to protect reproductive rights back in August. So I think this is a great persuasion, turnout, and education opportunity.
No, and I agree with you, especially in a state like Pennsylvania, where we are very close. Then you know, the turnout can be very close at times. This is one of those issues that make maybe get people thinking a little differently. Because look, you know, I know some Republicans who are like, look, I believe in, you know, being a little bit more conservative on fiscal issues, fairly a little bit socially liberal-ish, not, you know, too far. But this is one of those moving things where, you know, when I was talking to a friend, I said, look, you know, what happens if something happens to your daughter, even if it's not rape or incest, even if, you know, if she's 15 and something happens, do you want to force that that life choice on her? And he's like, no. And I said, then this is the issue you vote on.
Right. Yeah, I kind of agree with you more. I think, you know, as Democrats, we need to have this be our central campaign message. You know, voters go to the polls. They have a bunch of considerations. But, you know, we need to make this the key consideration. And that's what happened in 2022. And that's what's happened so far this year. Yeah. So I think Democrats, you know, we need to be running on this. We need to be hitting, you know, Republicans on this consistently, starting now, you know, 2023 and then to the elections, because this is what voters believe. Voters, you know, Republicans as well. It's like 2/3 of Americans believe in making Roe v. Wade law of the land again. So we need to run on this message. We need to win. And then we need to keep our promise and make Roe v. Wade law of the land, because Republicans don't want that. That's out of touch with the voters want. Democrats, like our organization and candidates, they want Roe v. Wade to be the law of the land again.
Now, the bigger issue here for me, you know, now this is a big issue, especially your ad. The bigger issue for me here, Joe, is the fact that Republicans have taken that freedom angle. They've said they're the party of freedom. This is a freedom issue. You know, things people do in their bedroom, a freedom issue, who you love and who you spend your life with, a freedom issue. You know, down the line, you know, Democrats don't do enough of talking about the big picture. We focus on the details, and we focus on, you know, on telling you these big, long worded stories. This is really, really about freedom and individual liberty.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have, you know, Democratic politicians really trying to embrace the freedom angle, you know, people like Gavin Newsom, people like President Biden. I really think it's important, you know, Governor Shapiro, Bob Casey, you know, people like that really trying to hammer that message. And I think more Democrats could learn from things like that. As far as I'm concerned, this is the key message going into 2024, but it's also the privacy angle as well. You know, they do not want, or voters do not want, politicians of any party, but in this case, it's Republicans, because they are very out of touch with voters, invading their personal lives. You mentioned marriage, for example. You know, we're going to be producing sequels to our, you know, Keep Republicans Out of Your Bedroom, you know, Stop Republicans from Watching Your Daughter, One place we do not want a Republican congressman who's very extreme, you know, Scott Perry or anybody, for example, in Pennsylvania, would be at a same-sex wedding. You know, we should not be telling people who they can and cannot marry. But then you had a majority of the Republican congressional delegation across the country, you know, vote against, you know, making same-sex marriage and codifying it into law of the land. So as far as I'm concerned, we need to be highlighting these freedom issues, because that's what voters really do care about.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that you bring up my congressman, Scott, pardon me, don't look at my cell phone, Perry, because he is one of the more extreme. In fact, he's one of the people driving the potential government shutdown, which is why I'm hopeful that the good people of Pennsylvania, or of the 10th district where I'm at, look at Eugene DePasquale, who has been a good public servant here in Pennsylvania for a very long time. So the hope is that that we send Perry back where he belongs, just aside from our conversation, right. Because ultimately we've got to get rid of some of the crazy in Congress, because things clearly not getting done.
Yeah, absolutely. I think democracy, you know, and these abortion rights issues, you know, you have this gerrymandering going on in Wisconsin. You have it going on in so many different states, and Scott Perry, you know, very involved in January 6th. And all these issues are related. You know, the American people are very clear that they want reproductive freedom, and they don't want Republican politicians invading their bedrooms, invading their personal lives, invading their doctor's offices, telling them what they can and cannot do. But, you know, if Republicans have gerrymandered things so badly and are trying to overthrow our democracy, then it doesn't really matter what voters want, because it won't be a democracy. So I think we need to walk and chew gum at the same time and be on that message as far as the Democratic Party goes.
Now I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Joe Jacobson. He's the founder of Progress Action Fund. You can check out their website, progressactionfund.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Also see the videos that we've been talking about. And look, I'd love to hear what you've got to say on that. Now, I got to get your thoughts on this most recent ABC Washington Post poll, where the blaring headline, Trump edges out Biden 51-42 in head-to-head matchup. 51-42 is not edging out. I don't know who wrote that idiotic headline. But are you concerned that what we're talking about, what you're pushing out, isn't resonating with folks when they're looking at that matchup?
Yeah, I mean, those numbers are definitely not where we would want them to be. However, I would say that, you know, it's still very early and that we shouldn't just look at one poll. You know, the aggregate polls, there's a bunch that have been very close. So I think let's wait for more data to come in before we start sounding the red alarm. I think a big factor for Democrats was back in 2022, or in 2022, was that you had voters who didn't approve of the president. An independence break for the president, despite not approving of him. And that's because Republicans are so extreme. I think President Biden has a great record, you know, whether that's infrastructure, whether that's climate change, whether that's jobs or healthcare. You know, I think he has a great record, and I think they need to start spending a whole bunch of money to make sure voters know just how great his record is. As far as our organization goes, I'm not concerned, because Republicans are just so extreme that, you know, maybe somebody doesn't love the president. But at the same time, they're never going to vote for somebody like, you know, Doug Mastriano or Marjorie Taylor Greene, who are now the quintessential Republican. They're not even extreme for a Republican anymore. And I think Biden's quote is pretty on point. You know, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. And certainly Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, and all these, you know, extremist MAGA Republicans. I'm not worried about the poll, because voters are going to see what's going on coming up next year for sure.
My problem with all these polls is they're all BS. I think you can rig them all to say whatever you want to keep a horse race going, so you get people continually clicking through to make money and make this a horse race. I don't know what the ultimate end point's going to be. I can guarantee one thing. It is not going to be 51-42.
No, there's no way. I mean, last cycle, you know, polls on aggregate, from my understanding, weren't terrible. But then you go into some of these races, you know, New Mexico's second or Ohio's first. And just the polling there was just so variable. You know, you have a lot of different entities and organizations and media outlets, you know, used to be conducting a lot more polls, but they just kind of stopped doing the abundance that they used to. So now it's just so hard to tell. So I think, you know, when you have one or two polls, it's kind of just like, you know, throwing you know what at the wall and hoping it stands out. So I think we'll know much more next year. But given the electoral success of Democrats all across the country, 538, they recently had an article highlighting how well Democrats have done in dozens of special elections. So like you were talking about, you know, you can kind of cherry pick the data to make the case that you want.
Yeah. The website, progressactionfund.com. Take a look at it. We'll get links out on social media. Joe Jacobson, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good video. I'm looking forward to the next one. Keep up the great work. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you, Rick. Really appreciate you.
Thanks so much, Joe. Appreciate it again. ProgressActionFund.org.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Gonna take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So evidently, some of the Republicans in Tennessee are, they're putting together a study group. They're putting down another group to say, you know what, we're going to not take any federal money for education. In fact, they're looking at turning down, what was it, some $1.9 billion in federal education funding. And they're figuring out, well, what would happen if we got all that? You know, we could cut all that science and art and music and math, and we cut all that stuff. We just do history. You know, good Republican, you know, Prager University, Hillsdale College history. That's what we could give the kids. Good brainwashing propaganda. And it's cheap. Now, me personally, I say, you know, being from Pennsylvania, you know, we could always increase funding. If they don't want the $1.9 billion, I know Pennsylvania would be happy to take it. Could help with education funding, especially in poverty-ridden areas, could give us a leg up in the competition to educate the future, get better jobs, all of that stuff. But it got me to thinking. It got me to thinking, you know, what would they cut? You know, how much could be gutted from education? And then I came across this story from Donovan Elementary School of the Lebanon City School District in Ohio, who evidently, you know, last Friday they thought it'd be a great idea to have Ice Cream Friday. And who in their right mind would be against Ice Cream Friday at whatever age? But these are third and fourth graders who, you know, clearly looking forward to ice cream on Friday. And as a kid going, oh my God, ice cream on Friday, that's going to be great. Can't wait for it. All your friends talking about, we're going to have ice cream on Friday. It's going to be fabulous. Can't wait. And then the Donovan Elementary School puts out on social media this gem of a post. Tomorrow is the highly anticipated first Ice Cream Friday. We wanted to send out a few reminders to hopefully make the day go smoothly for everyone. A student, here's the kicker, here it comes. You ready for it? A student must have money on their account to purchase ice cream. If a student has a negative balance, they will not be able to purchase ice cream, even if they bring their $1 for ice cream. Students are only allowed to purchase one ice cream and are not permitted to buy ice cream for a friend. We have to have a great first Ice Cream Friday. Really? This? Now, this story has, you know, from the media perspective, a happy ending. because that's how I found this. Oh, this is such a good feel-good story. Oh, this is wonderful. Some people in the community saw the post and reached out to the school and paid, you know, for all of the back debt, the debtor children, those third and fourth grader debtors, and gave an extra $5,000 so that kids would be able to have a little bit in the future so that they wouldn't go far into debt. Such a good feel-good story. And look, completely the wrong message. Good on the people for doing it, because I'll be honest with you. When I read the post, I'm going, you know, how much could it possibly cost to ensure that all kids got the ice cream? How about if I just buy the ice cream and say, give it out? Ice Cream Friday is a giveaway thing. Now, good on the people who step forward. You know, give them credit. Good citizens. Love people like that. But the message is that we need good Samaritans to come in to save the day. Otherwise children are going to be used as pawns in this. Imagine being a third grader. I mean, this is, and I've got some experience with this, but imagine being a third, fourth grader and being in debt. I mean, you go, wow, how is that? Well, we're teaching kids about the economy, especially poor ones, that your life is going to be a lifetime of debt, that a lifetime of struggle, a lifetime of being denied things because of the station in life that you were born into, because of the fact that you don't have enough money in your pocket to be able to buy ice cream on Friday, even if you can come up with the dollar. Because they're going to hold it against you that you didn't have the dollar, sorry. And we know what this was. This was a way to get people, parents, to cough up the money. Okay, well, the kids are behind. We don't want the kids to be left out. We don't want them to feel bad. Every parent thinks this way, rich or poor. But what about the parents who can't? And I think back to my mother. We didn't have money for things like this. The school used to have a carnival in the gym, you know, a nickel to play a game. We didn't have it. I had friends who would take me around and let me play for them because I was one heck of a pitcher. And I won people all kinds of stuff. Not for me, but for them. So I did get to play. This takes that away. Sorry, even if you got a friend who's got the extra buck, sorry, we're not going to let the friend do it. We're not going to let your friend be a good friend. Think about all of the messaging that comes out of this. Now, the school, after it became apparent that this was a terrible idea and that everyone was ticked off about it, they tried to say, no, this is how it's done. You know, this has been our policy. You know, ice cream's an a la carte thing. You know, it's something you can buy, you know, not from the regular meal, that we don't turn kids away from the regular meal. You just can't buy the extra stuff. But this isn't that. This isn't the kid deciding one day, hey, I want ice cream. This is the school district going, hey, it's Friday. Ice cream on Friday for everybody. Except you, and you. And this is my problem with where we are as a society. I'm telling you. You did this to my kid, I'd be fit to be tied. Only because I remember what it was like. I remember the humiliation. Why do we shame and humiliate kids? Because their parents don't have the resources. And I know, I can hear people go, you know, it's only a couple of bucks. No, school lunches are not cheap. Every day, $3-4 every day. And if you're making minimum wage, if you're making $10 an hour, I'm sorry, but $3 a day, $15 a week, $60 a month, that's a lot of money for a low-income family. And it's easy to fall behind. And then that number builds. And then the harassment starts. My daughter's too lazy to take money in every once in a while. So on Sunday, we get the call. Your daughter is delinquent. Seven cents. Your daughter is delinquent a dollar. And it keeps coming every Sunday. It reminds me of growing up in the Catholic Church, where on Monday the phone would ring and the person at the rectory would ask my mother why there was no money in the envelope in the collection plate. Because we didn't have any, was the answer. But we had to put the envelope in to prove attendance. It's the kind of place I went to. This kind of financial shaming, we've got to be better. It does terrible things to kids. And to have a school district whose main goal is to educate children do something like this is despicable. And I'm sorry, you don't get the fallback on, well, you know, it's an a la carte item. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Have you ever had anything like that happen in your life? Has there been a moment that you remember? And should we, as a society, just stop? You know, good on Michigan. They're talking about ending this nonsense. We'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, going back in the way, way back machine, today in Trump, the year was 2019, and it's the day that the transcript for the perfect phone call was released. Yeah, you remember the perfect phone call, the one said, hey, give me some dirt on Biden. Which, interestingly enough, you know, fast forward to, you know, 4 years, and we are now opening an impeachment inquiry into, well, the perfect phone calls beg for anything, information on anything, just whatever we can find. Yeah. Big fun. Big fun. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, the impending government shutdown, maybe a little bit on Bob Menendez refusing to step down. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So today was the day of the release of the transcript of the perfect phone call. Do you remember where you were when the transcripts were unfurled?
Yes, I remember I was in Belair, Ohio. I remember exactly where I was.
There you go. And thoughts?
Yes.
Thoughts on the perfect phone call transcript?
Well, it's kind of interesting because this is weird. I just was thinking about this. Okay, we had the perfect phone call to Trump. Trump wanted dirt. Now that you're right, the Congress is looking into the Hunter Biden Ukraine thing. Zelensky's still there, but the difference is now we're involved with a war, funding a war. Kind of been like the Ukraine thing, huh?
Yeah. No, I had someone tell me today it's Ukraine's fault that we're going to have a government shutdown. It's not that the Kook caucus is, you know, trying to get their pound of flesh. It's all about Ukraine.
Well, they'll stretch that. It's not about Ukraine. It's about abortion and Senator Tuberville. If it's not about that, it's about shutting down the education department. If it's not about that, and on and on and on, because they're trying to decide every philosophical moment in budget bills.
Any tomorrow the Speaker and the House is coming back into session. Any predictions? You're usually a good crystal ball into what the fun and entertainment's going to be. What are you expecting over the next couple of days as we tick down to the end of the month?
Well, this one's strange because Speaker McCarthy gave away everything to become Speaker when he did the motion to vacate Matt Gaetz.
Yep.
Blackmails him with that and et cetera, et cetera. McCarthy doesn't want to shut down. McConnell doesn't want to shut down, either one of them. But here's the twist to it. What McCarthy didn't do was the 11 appropriation bills, which he said he would do. Now, catch 22, he couldn't do the 11 appropriation bills because nothing's correct with about 12 of the 20 Freedom Caucus people. So he was stuck there. Although McCarthy should have just said, okay, too bad, here's what we're doing, vote up or down on the 11 bills. I'm suspicioning, this is a suspicion here, he's going to get some kind of short-term, two-week deal promising something, not to Gates, because no matter what he does with Gates, it doesn't work, but promising something to some of the Freedom Caucus members, or promising to continue to try to do the 11 appropriation bills, which is a legitimate complaint for some of the members. I think that's the direction it may go.
Yeah, but I'm looking at
now,
McCarthy.
The only thing,
No, go ahead.
The only thing that could change that would be wonderful for the system, and I know for a fact this is being done, for a fact, is the private reach out between Republicans and Democrats coming together. Now, because the Republicans control the chamber, and it was this way when I was there, Rick, the Democrats, rightfully and wisely so, are going to say, okay, if you want to do a deal, you've got to provide the majority of the votes. So if you need 217 votes, let's say that the Republicans have to provide 180, and then the Democrats provide 38 votes. That deal could happen if they come to a compromise on, you know, something agreeable to continue the budget, let's say past Christmas, probably. That kind of deal bipartisanly could occur, which would probably be healthy for the system.
No, this is where I was going to go. This is where I was going to say, in any functional democracy with any leader, you know, you don't even have to be a profile encouraged leader. You just have to be someone who's, you know, moderately functional. You know, go and do this stuff and make those 15, 20, whatever you need, make them irrelevant. And then use your power to try and get them out. That's how a functional system would work.
Exactly. Plus, at some point in time, McCarthy has to realize this trajectory path he is on leads to nowhere. It leads to John Boehner. Just bring up the past. Remember, John was going to be thrown out on a rail there. It leads to John Boehner. I stood there and watched Newt in private caucuses say, it's a democracy. We're going to have a vote. If you don't like me, remove me. I'll leave. You know, at some point in time, you have to stand up and say those things that you're not afraid. And if McCarthy doesn't do that, eventually he will be whittled down to the point where there will be a motion to vacate. Now, AOC the other day made an interesting statement, and that is, you know, McCarthy hasn't done much. Maybe they would support the motion to vacate. Well, either way, the Democrats could support it or not support it. Either way, it doesn't help McCarthy, no matter what's going down. So if I were McCarthy, I would just make some kind of, you know, temporary deal, which he'll probably do, continue to try to do the appropriation bills, and then throw them out amongst the general population. But in order to do that, for him to bypass the 12 problems, he has to have support from the Democrat side, period.
But that means you don't get to cut Social Security. That means you don't get to cut Medicare. That means you don't get to do some of the really ugly things that the Kook caucus wants.
Sure. And here's where he can benefit, too. McCarthy can say, look, we're not going to cut Social Security. We're not going to cut Medicare. We will bipartisanly, and with the interest groups, AARP, et cetera, we will look at how to firm Medicare and Social Security up. We'll look at it together. Great. Stops the controversy. They actually technically do look at, Lord forbid, public policy considerations, you know, to make sure it's around. I mean, there's a lot of great things it could do that no matter how much, I keep saying the 12 because it's not 20 anymore, but no matter how much the 12 complain, McCarthy would be, you know, in good position.
Yeah.
Period. Now, that means, though, that, you know, it's not down the line, we do everything with Republican votes. He can't do everything with Republican votes because he has people that want to be superstars like Matt Gaetz and run for governor, et cetera, that are going to stop every single thing he wants to do.
Oh, you didn't just say that. you didn't just say Matt Gaetz.
Oh, yeah.
For governor. Yeah. Oh, God.
Well, isn't that one way to maybe get rid of him?
and make things worse? But here's the thing. No, actually, now that I'm starting to think about it, Florida man as the head of Florida, yeah, sure, why not? What the heck?
You know, Florida's
a giant
down on
show
the,
anyway,
on the
so.
Beach, you know?
All right, well, there you go.
Maybe.
There you go. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman, political analyst extraordinaire. I want to get your thoughts on this Menendez thing. He said that he said that the envelopes that were full of cash you know, the $480,000, mm-hmm. you know, and the money he had stashed all over the place. It was for emergencies. He said that now this may seem old-fashioned, but these were monies drawn from my personal savings account based on the income that I have lawfully derived over those 30 years. And it's, you know, it's just safety blanket. Now, I do love John Fetterman's tweet on this. He said, we've got an extra flashlight in our home for emergencies. Thought that was perfect.
Well, I mean, look, if Carol's car breaks down, don't you have to have 20K somewhere to take it to the local Pennsylvania, you know, mechanic?
If I had an EV right now, probably. But no, I don't have that kind of money laying around the house, Bob.
No, don't you need that to get the brake line fixed for an emergency? I mean, you know, Menendez, when he... If he just said, I'm going to fight this, I'm innocent, you know, you sit there, okay, there's a court system, doesn't look good. When he came up with this, and that he basically came from a Cuban family where you had to, you know, store this cash in case the government, you know, something happened with the government. Hey, I understand our government's a little shaky here and there, but, you know, not to the point where they're going to come in and take your money. So his answer was just basically obviously ridiculous. And he would have been better just to say, I'm going to fight this, you know, instead of trying. When you answer these things, been there, done it, you either answer them all, you don't specific, because he didn't answer Egypt, but he answered the cash.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Now, what I find amazing is that he would go here to the emergency angle, knowing that 44% of Americans can't afford a $1,000 emergency, and he could afford 480 of those.
Right. I mean, all the way around, this isn't looking good. Like I said, I've been in the jackpot seat. I was fortunate. I did not have, when the whole thing began with me, I did not have, including Nancy Pelosi, I did not have people saying, you need to leave now. I didn't have that happening. What has happened with Menendez, and this is what happened, you know, it's selective who is told to leave, and some people fight it, and, you know, some leave. This situation with him, let's face it, is really, really ugly.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where people are not going to give him a benefit of the doubt on it.
No, and look, I said the last time we talked, he should just become a Republican, because they'd never ask him to resign. Now you've got Fetterman, who was the first person. Sherrod Brown came out, was the second, and also Peter Welch of Vermont, the third. I expect those calls to get, you know, louder and louder down the road. But he's defiantly saying, nope, not going to do it.
Yeah, this one's tough because the government, when they charge you with bribery and don't try to do a broad brush charge, which, you know, I had the honest services fraud, which is now unconstitutional if you can't link bribery. They're linking bribery. Because if he says that came out of his account, right there, number one, where's the track record? If it did, he will have withdrawals. If he doesn't have withdrawals on record, guess what? That's problem number one.
But, Bob, he was just saving change, man. The Big Mac cost, $5.50, that extra 50 cents in the pot.
You know, me, you, and if we both picked 10 friends on that we each know, we couldn't save that kind of cash in 35 years, you know?
This is true. I got to get your thoughts on Donald Trump's truth that he put out. He said, Mark Milley, who led perhaps the most embarrassing moment in American history with his grossly incompetent implementation of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, costing many lives, leaving behind hundreds of American citizens, and handing over billions of dollars of the finest military equipment ever made. We'll be leaving the military next week. This will be a time for all citizens of the U.S. to celebrate. This guy turned out to be a woke train wreck who, if the fake news reporting is correct, was actually dealing with China to give them a heads up on the thinking of the President of the United States. This is an act of so egregious that in times gone by, the punishment would have been death. A war between China and the United States could have been the result of this treasonous act, to be continued. Is he suggesting putting his old general to death, you know, kind of North Korea style? Is that what we're getting?
What? It's interesting. Gosar from Arizona, Congressman Gosar, he ended up making statements that made Trump look okay, if that's possible. I mean, Gosar's statements were beyond out of control. So all of a sudden, he actually made Trump look like, well, I'm just inferring, you know, years ago in the 1800s, this would have happened. Trump's logic doesn't make sense because of the fact that what the general did was to basically say to China, with the upheaval and all the rumors that were running around, he simply wanted to de-escalate any situation. And his message was very easy in his own quote: stay calm, stay steady, de-escalate. We're not going to attack you. That's not an act of treason. That's an act of trying to stop the rumors, because you know what was going on with information back and forth, rumors that, you know, that Trump was going to do anything humanly possible. And even though this wasn't a China-U.S. issue, things escalate.
Yep.
To the point where everybody gets nervous. So that's all that the general did. We were at war with China. He wasn't giving them information or doing something he shouldn't. But, this death thing, where do they come up with this stuff at?
Well, no, look, you know, my son has a friend who, you know, he's all pro death penalty. All these people, we should be putting them all to death. And it's, you know, that's an undercurrent of what we are hearing from the red hat crowd. This, you know, if you're with us, you're against us. And if now, if you're against us, we got to take you out.
I love how Trump says all of these people, all of them are idiots. And these are all the people he appointed. I mean, I love it.
No, they're the very best people. The very best idiots, though.
They were the very best, the best you could find on planet Earth, the most perfect phone calls, the most perfect people, and now they're the most all-perfect idiots.
And speaking of perfect idiot, Ron DeSantis back in the news. Evidently, Sean Hannity is going to moderate a debate between Ron DeSantis and Gavin Newsom. Why?
Well, the speculation. Well, first of all, if I were Hannity, I would, because I didn't even know DeSantis was still in the race.
I didn't know he was ever in it.
Yeah, I follow news. You know, if I were Hannity, I would moderate between Gavin Newsom and Nikki Haley, is what I would do.
Yes.
Honestly, if I'm going to do that kind of, you know, cheeky thing there, you know, cutesy thing, I would do it between Haley and Newsom. Really excite both sides, you know.
Yeah, but you're
with
not going to get
legitimate, because you're DeSantis
not going to get
could
Haley,
not beat
the two DeSantis and Haley. DeSantis would never do it. She would mop the floor with him.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that Newsom and Haley would be great.
No, I agree.
Oh,
Newsom and Haley.
I mean, DeSantis is done.
Okay. Yeah. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
I used to like Newsom until today, when he on Friday he vetoed AB 316, the automated truck bill. I'm very unhappy about that at the moment.
Why do you think he did that?
His claim is that there's already regulation in place to oversee the automated vehicles, the automated trucks. You know, I'm being told no, there's not. Originally, my thought was he vetoed it because it wasn't enough. It was a very watered down compromise bill, as it was. Look, it still allows automated vehicles on the road. It just says, hey, you got to have someone near at the controls for when it breaks down. Because if you look at what's going on with the taxis in San Francisco, not putting a lot of confidence out there as to these automated vehicles being able to run. So I'm a little miffed at it right now, but we'll see.
You add the word truck, it's automated truck terrifies me.
Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't scare me, it terrifies me.
As it should. You know, as I said earlier, right. I went to a Guardians game over the weekend, and we're sitting in a stadium full of about 15,000 to 18,000 people in the heart of downtown Cleveland, where you would think you'd get good cell phone reception. I got nothing. I could search nothing on the internet. I could text nothing. I could check no social media. Not that you want to, but I wanted to look up a couple of stats and stuff. Couldn't do it because there were too many people on the system. Now you're going to tell me rush hour traffic isn't going to put a lot of people on the system, and you're not going to have buffering and problems with 80,000 pound vehicles? It's a dumb thing. He should have signed it. And if someone gets killed because of it, it's on him. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see where it goes.
Right.
Finally, got to get your thought on the fact that a big majority, 65% of Americans, say that they want a popular presidential vote. Do we keep the current electoral system? Do we move to a popular vote, which almost two-thirds want? What do you think?
This is a tough one. I mean, I really went back and forth on this when I was in Congress about, you know, the popular vote. Yet the Electoral College was designed, well, for what the Electoral College was designed for, it doesn't count anymore, okay? Because it was designed for the wee tiny ones to make a difference. Now it's going to make a difference Electoral College-wise, depends on which state. You know, yeah. 2016 was, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio, our states, Michigan, Wisconsin. The original decision was so little states would have a lot of power to enter the union. So I'm tending to go towards, I guess, if I had to, a popular vote. I just don't think that the Electoral College will be done away with. We're always going to have this system where you've got to count the popular vote, and you've got to target states.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is the more you have the popular vote losing the election, the more you have a president who doesn't have the majority of people on his side. I think the worse that gets, and I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're getting there.
One day we will, because you could have an overwhelming popular vote. I mean, really overwhelming, and yet the electoral system depends on the state where they come in at, you know, and where the overwhelming vote is. The overwhelming vote could be in one state, which then you only get so many electoral votes, no matter if you take 90% of the vote in that state or not, you know. So, yes, it's not ripe yet. At some point in time, it will be. But, yeah, I went back and forth on it, but we've been ingrained with this idea of the Electoral College. But, again, Electoral College doesn't function today as it was intended to function back then, which was the power of the littlest states.
Yeah, I'm also in favor of, you know, doing something with the Senate. I'm sorry that Montana and Wyoming shouldn't have the same power as California and Pennsylvania.
Well, the Senate
just saying
me, because I've heard it from, you know, McConnell, we've heard it from Dole, we've heard it from Schumer, you know, whoever you want. You know, the nuclear option. While you brave souls, you're daring to go to actual majority instead of 60. Wow. Aren't they courageous?
They are.
It amazes
they're,
me.
They're right there. When it suits them, they're courageous.
Right. Well, maybe if more of them wear shorts, they'll get a little bit brazen. What do you think?
There you go. Bob, I appreciate the time as always. Great stuff, my friend.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks so much, our good friend Bob Nay. No, I mean, you know, at some point, I think we're going to hit that. What, Trump lost by 7 million votes. And I know, I've got friends who, no, they were stuffing ballots with old people. You know, they were getting old people to vote. And, you know, people were dropping off 10 ballots, you know, for them and their 9 friends, which, you know, is not right. It's not legal in a lot of states, which is a dumb rule, I think. I got to be honest. Because even if when they dropped off 10 or 15 of them, they still were legitimate ballots, still somebody's name on it, still someone married up to the registration, but no, can't have that. Cannot have that. Finally, this evening, for some reason, in the last week, I have talked about Taylor Swift more than I have talked about Taylor Swift in my entire life. I have said the words Taylor Swift back to back more than I have said those words back to back in my entire lifetime. But I got to tell you, I like her actions. And, you know, here's the thing. The right is going after her in a huge way, attacking her. And Sunday was the big attack. And why, you may ask? Why? Poor Taylor Swift, wholesome young woman, good musician, you know, popular with a lot of the people who like her music, all that. Well, you know, they're mad because she went to a football game to watch her boyfriend, and she promoted voter registration. I know, cardinal sins, but that's what they're ticked off about. This Clay Travis guy tweeted out, Travis Kelce, who is Taylor Swift's boyfriend, I guess, says is doing Bud Light and COVID shot commercials. He needs to fire all his marketing agents, or he just needs to go ahead and cut off his, he uses the D word, become a chick and endorse Joe Biden. And then the following the comments after, you know, calling him a simp, just Travis Kelce, you know, calling him, you know, all kinds of, you know, beta, all kinds of stuff. And my challenge in this, from Clay Travis on down, walk up, get out from behind your screen, get out from behind the security of your basements, and go say any of those things to Travis Kelce. Who I despise, by the way, because he plays for the Kansas City Chiefs. But he's a heck of a football player and someone I would not want to cross with. So go say those nice things to him. And, you know, calling him a simp and calling him a beta, I guess all words for less than manly, if you want to throw that in there, to a guy who's going home with Taylor Swift. To a guy who caught a touchdown pass during a football game, who's literally nuts. it's quite remarkable for me to listen to the keyboard warriors attack these two. Quite remarkable. So good on Taylor Swift. Got to tell you, I'm thrilled to say those two words back to back. And in fact, a bunch of people saying Taylor Swift for president. I am not there. But, you know, we could probably do worse. You know, Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Chris Christie, Vivek Ramaswamy, yeah, and the rest of the cabal of crazy on that side. But good on her. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.